Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Okay, before we start, New York City. If you're listening and you live in New York, you know somebody who lives in New York.
Or New Jersey, you know, Long Island.
Yeah, wherever. New York-ish. Know that we have a live show on Wednesday, May 16th. We are taping a new episode of a series that is shortly to be here from amazing producer Molly Webster. It's all about sex, this particular event, particularly sex ed. Come join Molly and company for a night of stories, debate, and nervous laughter. You can get tickets at radiolab.org/sexed. It's going to be good.
Also, what you're about to hear is going to be good, but we should warn some of you that there will be descriptions in this upcoming podcast right now that are kind of grim and about people dying in the desert. So if there's kids in your house or you don't want to listen to that, maybe take a break. But otherwise, here we go.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yep.
So we come back here where you see you had another case.
Oh, and this. Oh, what? What is? What are those hairs?
Or that's dried muscle.
Oh, that's so muscle.
The closest thing I can say is the muscle dries out, so it gets stringy and shredded.
Okay, wait. Let's just start from the beginning. Okay, so we are in what room was this again?
We're in the special procedures room.
Okay.
Of the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner, and what we're looking at here is a case. Mostly skeletal remains.
So we have a skull. We have a few. We have some parts of
the spine.
Spine, it looks like, and then just two.
And all three major bones of the lower limb. So the two thigh bones, the femurs, and the two tibias, and the two fibulae. We know it's the male. He's an adult.
Okay.
20 to 30 to 40 year old migrant. He came in late January, early February, and animals found him. Maybe 50% of his skeleton is missing. His upper limbs and his pelvis and most of his spine are missing, and his hands and feet are missing. We have evidence here that a vulture was feeding on the person.
I don't know if this is...
That's a beetle. That's a dromestid beetle.
That's a beetle?
It's called a hide beetle. They're found globally.
Right.
And these hide beetles specialize in eating dried, hard tissue.
So he's still eating.
He is.
Wow.
He was in the body bag. He and his colony would have been on the body.
Wow.
In the body bag. And although we try to get most of them off during our exam, you can see there's lots of little crevices where a single bug could be.
Wow. Oh, wow. That's so... Yeah, wow.
I'm Chad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And today we present the final episode of our Border Trilogy.
With producers Latif Nasser and Tracy Hunt, and this is episode 3.
Which we're calling What Remains.
Yeah, okay, so just to catch everyone up.
Here's Latif.
The person I was just talking to, his name is Bruce Anderson. He's a forensic anthropologist at the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner in Arizona, which is where when they find a body of an unidentified migrant in the Sonoran Desert, that's where they bring them. And Bruce had been working there, you know, on and off since the 1980s. But he told me that it was only in the early 2000s that he started seeing, you know, just more and more and more of these migrant bodies being brought in.
And we're just crushed by the weight of all the dead and all the missing persons reports. And, you know, it's like working a mass disaster when people are still dying and planes are still crashing around you. And you throw your hands up in the air sometimes and you just think, when's it going to stop?
And it hasn't stopped. The number of bodies found last year was in the same range as the year before. The number of people crossing did go down after Donald Trump's inauguration, but traffic has basically rebounded. So people are still coming through the desert. They're not being deterred, which made us wonder, is deterrence, that fundamental idea behind our current border policy, is it even possible? Now, in some ways, that's a policy question, which we talked about in our last episode. But it's also a human question.
Is Jason still there?
I'm still here.
And that's what led us back to the person who we started this whole journey with, the anthropologist Jason DeLeon.
All right. Can you hear Latif too?
I sure can. Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
Fantastic.
Well, I feel like maybe we should just start off where we left off, which is that you were going to tell us the story of Maricela.
Sure.
When was this, by the way?
This would have been June of 2012.
Okay.
So we had been about 2 weeks into the pig experiment. And
this is a series of experiments where Jason and his team, mostly students, looked at how pigs decompose in the desert in order to understand how people decompose in the desert.
And it wasn't until about 2 weeks into this experiment where we were out hiking one day with a group of about nine people.
Down in southern Arizona.
And so on this particular day, on this trail that I had hiked many, many times, a student had run ahead to check stuff out and was taking pictures of us as we were walking up this hill. He turns around, starts yelling at us. He says, hey, you got to come up here. Something has happened. So I threw my backpack down and I race up this hill. And by the time I get up there, I see that he's kind of staring at this body that's just laying face down in the dirt on this trail.
Like a fully intact body.
Yeah.
A woman's body.
You could tell it was a woman because she had long hair. You know, she's wearing camouflage clothes, stretch pants, women's running shoes on. She's got a scrunchie around her wrist. But the rest of it, I mean, her body was incredibly bloated. I mean, to the point where it looked like it was about to pop from all of the gases that had built up inside of her body cavity. I didn't know what to do at this point. I mean, you know, the students start walking up. I mean, these are young students. We had someone in the group who was 18, 19.
For some of the students, this is the first time they've seen a dead body. One of them was crying.
I tell everyone, I say, hey, look, you got to go sit down and give me a second here to figure out what it is we're going to do here.
So first he called the police.
We did that, and then we kind of had a conversation. Are we going to photograph this person? Are we going to record any information? Are we still doing research right now?
And Jason decided, yeah, we should document this.
You know, we took some notes down.
Gray to green discoloration.
About what she was wearing.
Brown to black discoloration of arms and legs.
Took some pictures of the body.
Her fingers have started to curl. Her ankles are swollen to the point that her sneakers seem ready to pop off. There's a steady hissing of intestinal gases.
And then it just got to the point where I was like, okay, this is enough. I don't want to do this anymore.
And so they covered her with a blanket because Jason noticed the birds.
Circling overhead.
Four turkey vultures. And so at that point, they just sort of sat down and waited.
For the police to come, the sheriff.
An hour went by, two, three, four.
Just waiting with the body.
It was about 5 hours in that a sheriff and three Border Patrol agents show up, and they had hiked 3 miles to get to Jason with a stretcher. And so they bring the stretcher. The sheriff puts on gloves. He asks them a few questions, like, did you guys put the blanket on there? And then they roll her into this white body bag. And as the authorities do that, Jason, because she was face down, Jason gets to see her face for the first time. And so he writes a paragraph in his book, and it's pretty gruesome, but I'm gonna read to you the paragraph that he writes about it in his book. As her body turns, I see what is left of her face. It is frightening and unrecognizable as human. The mouth is a gnarled purple and black hole that obscures the rest of her features.
I can't see her eyes because the mouth is too hard to look away from. The skin around the lips is stretched out of shape as though it had been melted. Her nose is smashed in and pushed up. She died face down, and the flesh on the front side of her skull has softened and contorted to fit around the dirt and rocks beneath her. The scene is a pastiche of metallic gray and pea green. Whatever beauty and humanity that once existed in her face has been replaced by a stone-colored ghoul stuck in mid-scream. It's a look you can never get away from. After this thing had happened, and it really just shook me in a lot of different ways.
Jason says he just couldn't shake the question. Who was this woman? How did she end up face down in the desert? So that night...
I remember Jason calling me...
Jason called a friend of his, a woman named Robin Reinecke.
Him being really clearly shaken and, you know, asking for advice.
Robin actually runs this nonprofit
in Tucson called the
Colibri Center for Human Rights.
Colibri Center for Human Rights. And they do a lot of work with the missing and with bodies that have been recovered.
So Jason tells her,
look, today we had this thing. We found this person out here. And
could you help us ID her? Now, the thing is, Robin's office is actually in the medical examiner's office. So that means that just down the hall from Robin is the guy we met at the beginning, Bruce Anderson.
Probably a couple hundred people, or at least bones of a person, are in here.
Bruce is working on the medical examiner's side. So anytime an unidentified migrant body comes in, Bruce tries to piece together who this person is, looking at
the dimensions and the shape of the skull. And
markers.
Robustness of the bones.
Like looking at the length of the bones or the density of the bones.
By the non-fusion of these separate bones.
Looking at whether some bones in the body are fused together, which is something that happens right after puberty. Bruce can actually figure out approximately what age the person is, what gender, height, weight. And in the case of the woman that Jason found, her body was surprisingly in relatively good condition. So pretty quickly, they were able to determine, you know, she's probably in her 30s. She's 5'4". They were actually able to get fingerprints from her as well. Meanwhile, on the other side, on Robin's side.
Wow. So each of these tabs is a person. Is that right?
Yeah.
She's dealing with hundreds of missing persons reports.
All day, every day.
She spends her days taking calls, going through her voicemail.
Which is full of relative searching. I'm looking for my uncle. He disappeared in 2010. Or I'm looking for my daughter. She crossed 2 weeks ago. We haven't heard from her.
And she's also getting tips from different people, different aid organizations. And it's actually one of those calls that leads to a break in the case of the body that Jason found.
Huh. Okay, so this is an email from me from 2012. Hi, Jason. Just a quick update regarding the woman that your group found. The case number is 12-1567, and as of yet, she has not been identified.
But Robin tells Jason that she got a call from an aid organization that had spoken to a guy who had crossed the desert with a big group of people around the same time and around the same area where Jason found the body.
He said that he had recently left behind two fellow travelers who were in serious medical distress.
He said one of them was an elderly man.
70 years old.
And the other was a woman maybe from Guatemala or Ecuador, late 30s, early 40s.
It isn't certain that this group is related to ML-12-1567, but it's highly likely. I will contact Guatemalan and Ecuadorian consulates regarding new missing persons cases.
And eventually, using all the information that got gathered, Robin was able to determine that the body that Jason found, it's the body of a 31-year-old Ecuadorian woman named
Maricela Aguipoya.
Maricela Zaguipuyas. Robin gets in touch with Jason to tell him. Jason then asks her,
I would just would appreciate if you could, you know, help me at all connect with this family.
That request would, oddly enough, lead Jason to New York City.
That story in just a moment.
Hey, it's May from Cincinnati, Ohio. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Hey, Lulu here. You asked, and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt, and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon / not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program. That is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you, either way, for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out. And thanks.
Chad.
Robert.
Radiolab.
We are back with the third installment of our Border Trilogy, What Remains.
And when we left, Jason, along with Robin from the Calibri Center, had managed to ID the body of the woman he found in the desert. And so now he was trying to get in touch with her family.
I don't know. When people disappear or when they die in the desert, I think that the families make up, you know, lots of stories run through people's heads. And so I was hoping that if I could find this person's family, I could at least say, this is what it was like when we found her. This is what we think had happened.
So Robin was eventually able to get Jason the contact information for
Maricela's brother-in-law,
who we'll call Fernando.
And I make the awkward phone call that says, hey, I'm the person that found Maricela in the desert, and I would like to come and see you if that's possible.
Turns out Fernando actually lives in New York City, but he had spoken to Maricela just before she left. And when we heard his story, we decided, okay, we better send a reporter, Tracy Hunt, to talk with him.
Yeah, so I went to visit Fernando at his apartment in Queens.
Kimberly, please!
He lives there with his three dogs. Friendly guy, a little shorter than me, neatly dressed. He's got, you know, dark hair, longer on the top, shorter on the sides. And when I got there, he pulled out a bunch of photos of Maricela.
So this is their marriage, their wedding photo.
Ese es el matrimonio de ellos, la foto.
Ah, okay.
She was his brother's wife.
They look so young. Were they 19 when they got married?
Creo que como 20, 20 y algo.
So in this picture that Fernando's showing me, it's his brother and Maricela. They're in a church and they're posing at the altar. She's in a white satin gown. Her hair is long and dark and shiny, and she's got kind of like an oval-shaped face and you know, she looks beautiful, but even though it's her wedding day, the thing that struck me is that she's not smiling, not even a little bit.
Was she serious like that?
Yeah, actually, that's part of the reason why my mother said she didn't like her as much in the beginning. She said, you know, she always has an angry face on. She looks like somebody who doesn't have a lot of friends.
And on top of that, Fernando says she also had a habit of getting his brother in trouble.
You know, she would tell my brother to sneak out of the house to go see her, to go out dancing, to parties without permission, you know, those kinds of things.
But Fernando says she eventually won the family over.
She helped out at home. She treated my mom really well.
Especially his mother.
Actually, I think my mother loved her more than she loved us.
So Maricela and Fernando's brother, they got married. They ended up having three kids, two boys and a girl. Maricela had a job in a factory that made counterfeit jeans, I think Levi's. And Fernando's brother, he would go around to different villages selling sodas. And they just couldn't really manage to make ends meet.
They were living real rough at the time. I mean, when I went to the house and saw where they had lived.
So Jason, after he connected with Fernando, he actually ended up going down to Ecuador to meet Maricela's family.
Before she had left, I mean, they were living in a one-room plywood shack with a dirt floor. And animals running through the house. And, you know, and she had told her relatives, she's like, look, my kids are literally starving here.
So, como ese tiempo estaba yo construyendo la casa para mis padres y también iban a ir.
At the time, I wasn't able to help out as much financially because I was also helping build a house for my parents where they were also going to go live. And so I wasn't able to support them as much or help out with things like school. And so, you know, what she really wanted to do, you know, in order to, like, send her kids to school and all that, she really wanted them to have what she never had. Because she never had anything. And so that was really the pressure that she was under.
So Fernando says in 2012 he called home.
Entonces cuando una vez yo llamé a mi país y mi mamá me dijo que ella quería hablar conmigo.
One time when I called home, my mom said that she wanted to talk to me. So I said, okay.
Maricela got on the phone.
And she told me that she wanted to come here.
She told him that she and his brother, they wanted to follow in his footsteps. That if they could come to New York like he had, they could make money, send it back home, and help out their kids. That was the only way. And immediately, Fernando was like,
profundamente que no es bueno.
Absolutely not. No.
So Fernando told her no because he didn't want her to go through the same thing he went through 10 years before.
2001,
he was 17 years old, about to turn 18, and his aunt was about to go to New York. And she convinced him and his parents that if he went to New York, he'd be able to get a job, make more money, and support his family from there.
To have a better life, to have the things we needed. So my father thought about it and gave his permission, but he told me not to stay here too long.
And so he used his grandfather's land as collateral and took out a loan for
$12,000. $12,000?
Wow. Yeah.
Do you know what the interest rate was on the loan?
10%.
10%.
Yeah. So one thing that a lot of people have talked about is the fact that prevention through deterrence, it professionalized the human smuggling business because not only did these migrants need, you know, guidance from all these South and Central American countries, they also need guidance through the desert. So now you have the smuggling business that's more expensive and also more dangerous.
Oh, no. El coyote nos dijo que máximo era 15 días.
Yeah, so the coyote told us that 15 days maximum to get here.
Fernando says he and his aunt took a bus from Ecuador to Peru, and then from Peru, they flew to Panama.
Entonces, cuando dijimos, llevaron a Panamá, primera vez que me
got on another bus.
Al siguiente país.
And then somewhere in Costa Rica,
I remember the path, and really mountainous. There was a river, all that.
This bus pulls over, and the coyote who was with them at that point just said,
okay, you have to get off here. When we got out, they took our luggage and they threw them on the ground towards the river. And they said, you have to cross the river and someone will find you there and signal to that person. And we were left there like that, with my aunt saying, hold on, that wasn't the deal. The deal was to take us all the way to Mexico in cars. But from that point, when we started crossing mountains on foot, that's when horrible things started to happen.
From that point on, they were packed into the trunks of taxis, hidden in basements, chicken coops, and huts.
Totally filled with rats.
And 3 months into this journey, a journey that was supposed to take just 15 days, somewhere in Mexico, Fernando says that he and his aunt are taken to this rundown hacienda. This just sprawling ranch house. Inside the ranch house,
there were more than 250 people there. From all over the world, Chinese, Central Americans, from every country, from all over South America.
There's all these rooms filled with people, and Fernando actually says that there were all these armed guards all over the place. Nobody was allowed to leave.
And so we were
casi un mes encerrados ahí.
Pending there for about a month.
And while he was there,
this part I didn't tell Jason what happened to me there.
Ahí me abusaron de mí sexualmente.
I was abused sexually.
Fernando says that he was sitting outside the hacienda one day with his aunt when a group of men approached him and told him that he had to go inside with them. And he said no, that he was fine sitting there, you know, outside.
Yo contaba con mi, pues mi tía se le suplicó a ellos que no, no me hicieran nada a mí, que
my aunt begged them not to hurt me, to please not abuse me or do anything to me. And they said, no, don't worry, that they only wanted to ask some questions inside, but that wasn't what they wanted.
They told Fernando, look, you can come with us now, or you can come with us later after we beat up your aunt. So finally, Fernando relented and went with them. And when they got inside the hacienda, they went into a room. And
once we were inside,
cuando ya subieron adentro, pues, abusaron de mí.
They raped me 3 times.
How many of them were there?
Como 6.
Like 6.
Después de eso, que ya me quiero... Yo quería solo morirme, quería así pedir.
After that, I just wanted to die.
After a couple of weeks, Fernando and his aunt finally got out of this hacienda, and they start their trek into the desert. Fernando thinks that he went through the same desert that Maricela would try to cross 10 years later. He's actually caught by the Border Patrol and held for about a month before he manages to bail himself out of detention and make his way to New York. And Fernando says he shared all of this with Maricela, except his own rape. But he did tell her that migrants do get raped,
sí,
that he's seen it happen, that he knows it happens.
Y incluso cuando le dije eso, me dijo que no importa que
even ya... when I told her all of that, she said none of that would happen to her. She knew how to defend herself, and, you know, if she had to, she would hit people.
And then he told her, you might have to go without food or sleep outside.
But she said that it didn't matter, that all that mattered was getting here, because the kids are the ones that matter most.
Va a valer la pena por los hijos.
That any sacrifice made is worth it for your kids.
And then he doesn't talk to her anymore. That's actually the last phone call they ever have, because he thinks that if he cuts her off, maybe she'll just give up. But she goes to one of her brothers, and her brother says that he would only pay for her to go, but he's not going to pay for her husband to go.
When you found out that she was going to come by herself, did you try to tell your brother, look, you shouldn't let her come here by herself? Come at all, I should say?
Sí, sí le llamé, pero mi hermano me explicó.
Yeah, I called, but my brother said that there wasn't another option, and that he wanted to go first, but her brother had put the condition that she go first. And because they didn't have another option, she said she would go.
In May of 2012, Maricela left Ecuador. About 3 weeks later, right before she walked into the desert, Maricela sent her family a message on Facebook. She told them, I don't know how I'm going to get there, but I am going for my family. God willing, I will get there.
When did you finally hear what actually happened to her?
Y me acuerdo un día, estaba trabajando, eran como las...
Someone called me. He told me they were from the consulate, and I said, okay, finally, she's been found. And then they told me.
Y yo dije, ¿qué pasó? Entonces ellos me dijeron que Maricela está muerta y no saben qué día.
Maricela was dead, and they didn't know what day exactly she died, but that she'd been dead for about a month.
Exactamente murió, pero más o menos que ya tenía un mes muerta.
It was just really difficult wondering if I'm going to do more damage than good by going to meet these folks.
8 months after Maricela's death, Jason came to New York to meet Fernando, and he brought with him the pictures of Maricela's body that he took when he found her in the desert.
You know, he was like, just right now, show me the photos. And I was just dancing around that for over an hour.
Jason warned that the photos were really upsetting. There were so many like that. But I said that it's okay to show them to me. And
I give him this book of photos that I've printed out. And it's got pictures of this shrine that we built for her in the desert. It's got pictures of my students who were there. And then eventually, it's just pictures of, like, the back of her head. So it's her hair. It's some of the clothing. It's her hand.
I saw all the photos, and the truth is that it tore me to pieces to see or imagine everything she had to endure in the desert. She tried to keep going, dragging herself. Jason brought me photos of how she was found and her body outstretched, trying to keep going.
Before Maricela's body was sent back to Ecuador, Fernando decided they should have it sent to New York first.
When I talked to my family, I said, you know, her dream was really to arrive here. And so I thought, at least we can fulfill that dream with her body. To be able to have a wake for her here.
They held the wake at a funeral home in Queens. Almost 100 family members and friends came to celebrate Maricela's life. They were told to keep the coffin shut. The next day, her body went back to Ecuador. Fernando had to stay in New York because he knows if he were to go back to Ecuador, it would just be way too hard to try to come back to the United States. He says that, you know, right now he's just trying to fulfill a promise.
The promise that I made to Maricela's body when it arrived here, that I was going to look after her children. I was going to try to give them what she had wanted for them.
When you think about that conversation, do you think that there's anything you could have said that would have made her stay?
I told her what could happen along the way. I thought that would be a way of deterring her.
No.
And it's worth pointing out, more generally, prevention through deterrence as a strategy, it hasn't deterred people from coming to the U.S. either. The annual budget for the Border Patrol is roughly $3.5 billion bigger than it was in 1990. We have about five times as many Border Patrol agents. And yet the number of people, immigrants living here undocumented, has more than tripled during that time, from 3.5 million to about 11 million. And more people are coming every year, every day, and more people are dying along the way.
Yeah, let's just do it here.
About a year after Maricela died, Jason got a call from her family again.
Do you want Maverick or Iceman? You have to name the drones.
You guys are Top Gun fans. Yeah.
Another family member had disappeared in pretty much the same place Maricela did.
So which is this?
I think that's Maverick.
That's Maverick.
I'm going back to the Arizona desert basically because Maricela has had a cousin, a 15-year-old cousin named Jose Takuri, who disappeared almost 1 year to the day that she died. Uh, I was able to kind of triangulate based on interviews with people who he was with and with information from various folks where we think he went missing. I mean, I told his mom that I would not stop looking, and it took me a couple of years to figure out a way to do that. But right now, it's we'll go back and we'll use these drones and see what we can come up with.
And you know better than anyone what happens to bodies in the desert now, I think. I mean, why are you still looking for him? Or why, you know, yeah, as callous as that question sounds, I guess.
For me, part of it is I just don't know what else to do. You feel so hopeless. I told his mom, like, I won't stop looking for him. I'll do whatever I can, whatever little thing that I can do. And if I can't find him, well, maybe I'll find somebody else.
Now, so we will.
What was that?
It's getting mad at me because it's running out of batteries. We'll do one. We'll do one more. One more run.
And challenges, and as always, provides great opportunities for the American people. It is a commonplace.
We will build a great wall along the southern border.
Where 40% of the babies born on Medicaid.
I'm not to testify based on my Fifth Amendment constitutional rights.
On the advice of counsel, I invoke my Fifth Amendment right.
You like America?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's your problem?
This mythical division between these two cities, it's just,
because of us, fences
when Agent Dale Music Aid vets about 40 students to divide
animals. It's a mess here.
Okay, here comes about 100.
They can't just arbitrarily stop you just because of the climate change.
Rush across the Rio Grande into El Paso.
Tight, remain tightly.
People being apprehended.
I want to use my Fifth Amendment defense.
Stop
because I appreciate it.
I can't.
This episode was reported by Latif Nasser and Tracy Hunt, produced by Matt Kilty and Tracy Hunt.
Jason DeLeon's book, which inspired this series, is called The Land of Open Graves.
Special thanks to our interpreter, Allison Corbett, and for giving voice to Fernando in English, Carlo Alban, and Carlo's manager, Ted Brunson.
Thanks also to Hayden Stewart, Raul Raz Pastrana, Paulina Alonso Chavez, and Ambassador Jacob Prado from the Government of Mexico, and to the staff at the Pima County Medical Examiner's Office and the Calibri Center for Human Rights. I'm Chad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening.
Lori from Katona, New York. Radiolab was created by Jad Abumrad and is produced by Soren Wheeler. Dylan Keefe is our Director of Sound Design. Maria Matasar Padilla is our Managing Director. Our staff includes Simon Adler, Maggie Bartolomeo, Becca Bressler, Rachel Cusick, David Gebel, Bethel Hapte, Tracy Hunt, Matt Kielty, Robert Krulwich, Annie McEwen, Latif Nasser, Melissa O'Donnell, Arian Wack, Pat Walters, and Molly Webster, with help from Amanda Aronchik, Shima Oliai, Jake Arlo, and Reed Cannon. Our fact-checker is Michelle Harris.
Thank you.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.